Welcome to It Shipped That Way, where we talk to product leaders about the lessons they've learned helping build great products and teams. I'm Alan Pike, and today's interview is with Paul Lambert. Paul is CEO and co-founder of smart heat pump startup Quilt, and previously worked in leadership at Google's Area 120, in product management at Google and Twitter, and was the founder and CEO of LearnDot. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you. It's really fun to be here.
It's been a lot of fun watching your path and in some ways our parallel but different paths from developers fresh out of school and ambitious and curious about the world to, you know, repeat founders tackling, interesting bigger problems. Obviously, maybe the audience doesn't know this yet, but the problems that you're tackling are at the very large, you know, sort of in some ways society scale, which is really fun and exciting. So I'm glad to have you on the show and looking forward to digging into that.
Yeah, likewise. And that's really kind of you to say. You know, we met a long time ago, sort of in the Vancouver tech community, both, I think, founding our first companies together just on different paths. So yeah, I don't know how much of that you want to share, but I think that is cool to sort of come up together and see where we are today.
It's not a secret, I think, on this show that a lot of the folks that we have on the show are folks that I've met many years ago. And, you know, you meet interesting people and obviously it pays a lot of dividends in a career to just have conversations and get to know people and listen to people and then stay in touch and keep an eye on people who are doing good work. And so that's paying dividends. And 10 years later, I can be like, oh, Paul's working on some cool stuff. Let's get him on the show.
Cool.
So before we get into some of the specific stuff at Quilt, some of the interesting challenges of being a hardware startup as someone with a software background, how do you like to sort of summarize your story so far in a way to give people a bit of context about who you are and what you're up to?
Yeah. So my story is, so I grew up in Canada, I think like you. I grew up in Calgary, and that's relevant because the industry in Alberta is largely the energy industry, and specifically the fossil fuel industry, and that kind of comes into the story later. But I grew up in a world where, you know, everyone worked for the oil companies, and it's a very kind of conservative place. I was a very much more kind of creative and artsy and didn't really fit in super well, and I was looking for a way to make stuff. I originally was much more like an arty, like I was into music and, you know, creative writing and things like that. I actually moved to Vancouver to do an undergraduate in creative writing and anthropology because my favorite author in high school was Kurt Vonnegut, and he had majored in anthropology, so I was like, I'll just do that. But I'd spent my whole life, I'd been into computers, and the way I actually made money as a teenager and in high school was making websites. So I originally made websites for like bands I was in, and then businesses started asking me to do it, and I was like, well, this is better than, you know, being a dishwasher. And for some reason, it never occurred to me that could be a career when I was coming out of high school. I think it's because I didn't have engineer role models in my life. For some reason, it felt more viable for me to like go be a like novelist than being like a software engineer. Like that was where my head was when I was 18. So anyways, I graduated from that degree. Discovered there aren't a ton of jobs for like aspiring 21-year-old poets.
Unfortunately.
And unfortunately, yeah. And I'll speed up a little bit, but it's an interesting segue. I ended up moving to China. So I had a friend who was teaching English in China. And in Beijing specifically, and this is right before the 2008 Olympics, I moved there. The big focus at the time was getting ready for the Olympics. And one of the issues was the quality of the language translation. And it was really interesting that they were struggling so much with this. The Olympic Committee, the hotels, and they were very aware that all these foreigners are going to come to Beijing and potentially get lost or have bad experiences. And one of the big issues was that most of the internet was blocked. So the people doing the translation on the ground couldn't watch YouTube. They couldn't interact with native speakers. But I had just graduated from a writing program with a bunch of people who were looking for work. And so I made a web app and hired my friends back home to essentially man it and started selling it as a package service to some of the businesses in Beijing. And this became my first startup. And it was the most incredible feeling. And all of a sudden, everything I'd been looking for in my life around this creative output, I was able to scratch with the technology side of my life. And it occurred to me that these two things can come together and that eventually, like, creating a new technology product and business was, like, everything I'd wanted, and it was, like, the most incredible feeling. That is how I got on this career path. It became super clear to me that what I wanted to do with my life was be a technology entrepreneur. The Olympics came and went. I also realized my computer science background wasn't as strong as I thought it was. So I went back to school, and I did a full computer science degree. It was a business on the side. Totally different experience. I was there, like, for one reason only, and that was, like, I was going to be, like, a Silicon Valley-style entrepreneur.
You're on a mission now.
Yeah, which turns out that panned out. And in my final semester of that, I was making like an app to access the learning management system at UBC, and it started getting popular. The next thing I know, some, you know, people reached out to see if I wanted to take investment, and I was like, holy crap, investors are talking to me. This is the greatest thing ever.
I've made it.
Yeah, and this became my first venture-backed startup, which was LearnDot. And we pivoted a few times out of the university space. Was the CEO of that for about 6 years. Ended up being a SaaS platform for largely other SaaS businesses that wanted to build a training around something to do with their brand, like a skill set for their brand. Like, you know, Hootsuite would want to have Hootsuite University so that people could learn how to be great social media marketers, and they needed a platform to run that. I was CEO of that for 6 years, as I mentioned. We were eventually acquired by a company in Palo Alto, so that got me down here to where I am now in California. I turned 30 the year that happened, and I felt like I'd never had a real job. I was like, I should probably do that. And even though I definitely identify as an entrepreneur, I want to kind of go learn from my heroes. Like, here I am surrounded by Apple and Google and all these companies. And I was like, I should go see how it's done in the major leagues before I go found another company. And so that was the plan. That's what I did. I actually went to Twitter first for 2 years as a product manager. Kind of fortuitously got exposed to some early AI work around recommendation systems for like ranking the timeline and things like that at Twitter. Then joined Google to work on AI around Gmail primarily. Actually helped build the first LLM at Google. So that was the Smart Compose in Gmail. And one of my engineering peers on that is actually now working on Bard, and it's really cool to see how that's evolved. And I blinked and 5 years had passed, and I'd been, you know, 2 at Twitter, 3 on Gmail, and I was ready to found my next thing. And I kept experimenting with ideas on the side, and I would try to play out what would happen. Say I was going to make some, I don't know, SaaS tool to do language completion for, I don't know, other tools other than Gmail. I could probably sell that as a service or something. And I would play it out, and I would realize I'd end up in exactly where I was before, which was 6 years into a company, trying to climb some monthly recurring revenue metric or annual recurring revenue metric. And my big lesson from LearnDot was that I was so excited about being an entrepreneur that I just ran with the first thing that had traction without really doing the inner work of like, that's really what I wanted to spend my life doing. Because it turns out I didn't care that much about corporate education. And I can say that now.
Yeah.
But that's a really hard thing to admit when you're the CEO of a company that does corporate education.
Yeah.
People think entrepreneurs have all this freedom, but they actually don't. Because in most cases, unless you've really got a level of success, like you can't quit. Like if you quit, basically the company fails. And so I knew I wanted to start another company, but also knew I needed to have a like serious level of conviction to do it. And I actually made the rule that I would only start a company if I would commit 10 years of my life minimum to it. And I think that's absolutely the right mindset, but it's really hard to get to that level of conviction, especially when you're, you know, you have a pretty great job at Google and I was making a good amount of money and I had a mortgage and I also had a kid and like very different situation from when I was, you know, like 22 in Vancouver. So I really struggled with that quite a bit. I figured that if I couldn't get to that level of conviction, I could back other people who did. And I was like, maybe I should be an investor. I could go be a VC. How was I going to do that? And out of nowhere, Area 120, which is effectively a seed stage fund within Google, reaches out to me and says, we're looking for an investment partner. We're looking for someone who understands how Google works, but also understands the startup ecosystem and investment. And I was like, great, this is awesome. So I applied for the role, got the job, spent my last years at Google essentially being a VC within Google. And it was great because I learned quickly that, like, you know, no offense to any investors on the podcast, but that wasn't the right path for me because I discovered that I was spending a lot of my time like evaluating business ideas and doing a lot of, frankly, internal politics, but not actually making things in the way that I, like, that's why I got into tech. I like building stuff. And I felt like I was very distant from it. Like, I'd be like, yes, go make this amazing thing. And then I would see them in 3 months or 6 months. And my wife had our second kid and I was on paternity leave. And I realized I really did want to start another company and want to make something from scratch. But how was I going to solve this 10-year commitment problem? And it seems almost cliche to say, but it was completely real for me that we just had this kid and I was thinking about sort of their life and what I was going to do with the rest of my career. And I realized that I just had to work on like what problem I genuinely believed was the biggest problem facing our kids' generation, the next generation of humans. Because that's a complete unlock. Because if you worst case scenario is you spend 10 years of your life trying to make life better for your kids' generation and you fail.
It's like inherently meaningful.
Yeah. Well, and also like so what? Like put that in my obituary. Like that's what I tried. Like I'm going to be proud to have tried. And the best case scenario is you make really significant traction against the most important problem facing humanity. And it's like, what more could you want, right? Like, so that was completely the unlock. And then it's like, well, what is that problem? And you can look at a lot of valid problems. Like World War III would be a big problem. But climate change really bubbles to the top when you're looking at level of number of human lives impacted, basically everyone, and the confidence bars we have around it happening and what those outcomes look like. We don't know exactly what is going to happen with climate change, but we know it's various levels of bad and it impacts everybody. And in some cases, it's very, very bad. And then, you know, as I was going through this in a very rational way, I get an email from my dad about how climate science is kind of made up. And I was like, oh, really? That's interesting. And of course, you know, because where he's coming from.
He's coming from Alberta, oil capital of Canada, and he's probably spending time on Facebook.
Yeah, he was the CEO of an energy company.
Oh.
Like, that's just like the world he lives in. And I was just like kind of overcome with this multi-generational responsibility, to be frank, that I just had to work on this for sort of my you know, this is the legacy I wanted to have. So then the question was like, okay, where can a guy like me make difference in climate change? I wasn't going to start a nuclear fusion company, even though that would be incredible if we could crack that for climate change.
You just have to go back to school a third time, I think, for that one.
Yeah, exactly, right? At this point, I'm halfway through my career. I felt like I wanted to leverage the skills I'd built. And I want to say, I think it's in some ways even bigger than climate change. It's like the energy transition is about like a new way of powering society. And if we do it well, it unlocks much more abundance and much better ways of living. And like, I think if we get things like fusion right, like it's going to be, you know, the next era of humanity. Like it's just incredibly massive. I'm a consumer tech person. That's what I've done most of my life. That's also the network I have. Like, I'm thinking about building a company. It's not just one person. It's who can I hire? Who are the world-class people I know? And here I am sitting in the middle of Silicon Valley, and I know I can build a world-class consumer technology company. So if you work for the consumer backwards, you say, well, where do they buy fossil fuels? Because those are both going to change in a major way if we're going to complete the energy transition. And it turns out they only do it in two parts of their life, which is kind of incredible. So you go out and actually exchange your hard-earned money for fossil fuels in your car, when you put it in your tank, and in your house, when you put it in your furnace and your hot water tank. But it's in your house and your water, or house and your car, and that is it. So that means to complete the energy transition on the consumer side, we only need to solve those two things.
Now you've simplified your search space. It's obviously big, huge problems, but you've simplified your search space now.
Oh, they're both like massive multi-trillion dollar markets, but there's only two of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's really nice. And also, it was really clear the car side was going well. Like the vehicle side was, you know, when I was first thinking about Quilt, I think Tesla had just passed $1 trillion market cap, and everyone was so excited about EVs. But you start digging into the impact, and it turns out the house side is a bigger problem. It's more emissions. Residential homes are about 20% of all emissions, the energy used in homes. Personal vehicles is 14 to 15%. Both big, homes are bigger. And there wasn't nearly the amount of energy or investment around innovating in that space, even though it seemed like in some ways a bigger opportunity. Also, maybe this is obvious to say, but homes are also worth more than cars. People invest more into them. They spend more time in them. Just this incredible mismatch of you know, what was required and level of investment happening. And then it was like, okay, so what's happening in the home? What's the biggest fossil fuel consumer in the home? By far, it's the HVAC system. It's over 50% of all energy and 70% of all fuel use. It's okay, so what's the game plan? Well, the game plan is heat pumps. And anyone who started to look into the space, you just hear this word over and over again. It's a horrible
heat pumps,
word.
Heat pumps, cools heat pumps.
And that's because at a technological basis, they sound like magic. They're more than 100% efficient.
Yeah.
And what that means is you get more than 100%. If you converted all the electricity into heat, you get multiple times of that because you're not actually converting electricity into heat. You're taking heat that already exists outdoors and just moving it inside. So it's more like a conveyor belt. But the net effect is incredible, so that when people adopt heat pumps, they actually lower their energy bills, even though they're switching from gas to electricity.
Even if you switch, even if you have electric baseboards where a lot of new construction in Vancouver, for example, has, you can still switch to a heat pump and you're using way less energy because it's that model that you're describing.
Oh, like four times more energy, less energy. Like it's not minor, it's like a quarter. And so if you're a policymaker and you're trying to figure out how am I going to get my society, my country, province, state, whatever, you're gonna push for heat pumps. Like that is just, it's kind of the only game in town. There's multiple different ways that they exist. You can get geothermal, you can get air source. I could get into that if you want me to, but it's obvious on paper it's a solution. So it's like, great. I went to go get a heat pump in my house, and it's like the record scratched. Everything about actually buying and adopting this product is just not good. It feels like the way things were done decades ago. It's like the internet never hit this industry. You can't really research stuff online. You can't buy anything online. There's all this misinformation that you talk to multiple contractors, they'll tell you different things. It takes weeks to even find out what the price is because someone needs to come to your house and, you know, look at it. And then the products themselves, by the way, you can get a central system that that looks on the surface like what you're used to. Like you get a Nest thermostat and everything that can control it. But generally, unless you're redoing all the ducting in your house, which is like open heart surgery on a house, you have a worse experience. And that's because the ducts need to be widened for heat pumps to work for heating. Because basically the air is not as hot because furnaces superheat the air. And there's sort of this assumed cooling. And so the problem is, if you don't compensate for that, and by moving more air, you don't get enough heat into the house. And then the other option, a lot of people are going to, these things called ductless or ductless mini splits.
Yeah, that's what I'm more familiar with.
Yeah, and people are familiar with them often as ACs, and they'll see them in Europe or Asia, they're very common. They don't feel premium, and they don't feel like an upgrade to your home the way that a central air does today. They're kind of ugly white plastic boxes. You have to put this large, ugly white plastic box in every room of your house. You don't have a thermostat anymore. You now have like a remote that looks like it was from 1985 and has like 50 buttons on it. And you have to find the remote for every room to just set the temperature. It's a total headache.
And then the remote gets lost. I was in an Airbnb where like the previous people's kid had accidentally pocketed the remote for the thing.
No, exactly, right? This just starts, all the alarm bells start ringing. It's like, this is exactly the type of problem where I can build a world-class team to solve it. I know how to build, you know, internet-enabled research and purchase experiences, and we can build a really great product experience around the heat pump itself, because the core is great. The core guts, the R&D is done, but no one has really thought about the user experience and how do you use the, frankly, digital and internet technologies the last few decades to make these things feel like a modern product experience. So it just felt like elevating heat pumps into something like a coveted category, something that people really excited to bring into their life, the way that the Model S did for EVs, right? It was the first EV that became a coveted car just for its own sake, not because it was good for the planet. It was more because it accelerated like a Ferrari. And it's like, what? How do we do that? But for the home space, and the biggest possible lever is starting with HVAC. So that's how Quilt was founded and how ended up here today.
I love it. You weren't as brief as I'd encouraged you, and I'm glad that you weren't, because that every part of that story was interesting, and it's gotten us to a really great place to actually talk about what you're building. It also helps that you've like hit on some of the things I'm personally interested in, which is this like intersection of how does one go from having skills in building stuff for consumers and building great experiences and then have a big impact. So that's a thing that's on my mind often. I want to dig into the hardware stuff on Quilt, but first, before we do that, I have a couple questions about kind of the beginning or the earlier parts of your story, and then we'll dig into Quilt a little bit more. So, you know, going back to LearnDot, which you kind of described that story of building this product that ended up, you know, pivoting a few times and, you know, having some form of success, but maybe not world-changing amounts of success. What were the big lessons that you learned from that process, and how did that like inform, we see the direction that you've ended up going in, and how did that inform that direction?
So some of them I think I already touched on, which is like just firsthand experience of being an entrepreneur trying to get a company like this built, is that it takes a long time and it's really hard. And so, you know, I'm not going to get a bunch of swings at this. So let's make sure that whatever you're working on is something you're going to be interested in for at least a decade and is the type of thing you'd want to be essentially your legacy. Like this is what you spent a lot of your work time on. I really don't believe in the try things and see what sticks. Maybe a bit of a hot take is I actually think product market fit, the search for that, is kind of a big distraction.
Oh, hot take. I love it. Tell me more.
I think maybe it's in the interest of entrepreneurs to encourage a bunch of really ambitious young people to search in the dark for something and just iterate based on some, you know, oh, I have a product and I'll just listen to user feedback and iterate with this product until I find a market. The vast majority of markets that are worth innovating in already have large transacting businesses built around them. And a lot of the innovation that really changes the world actually looks more like a better mousetrap, but like a way better mousetrap. And so what I mean is you want to solve a problem that has existed for humans for basically as long as you can think. And if I could explain your startup with a really simple analogy to my grandparents' grandparents, so like somebody who lived in the 19th century, then I think you're probably onto something. If I can't, and this is true for, I'd say, 90% of startups, you have a problem. And what I mean by that is like, okay, what's the analogy for Uber? It's taxis. It's horse-drawn carriages. It's getting around, right? What's the analogy for Google? It's the librarian, right? It's where you go to find information. What's the analogy for Quilt, I hope? It's the fire that people have had in their house for literally a million years to keep warm. And so really important problems have existed for kind of ever. And the solutions we have to them evolve, but the problems are fairly fixed. So when I say a better mousetrap is that there is some solution for this problem, but by leveraging technology, you can create a generational increase where, you know, it's this 10x better solution. So it's not incremental. It has to be 10x better. But I think you want to start with saying, here's my competitor. Here are the millions or billions or trillions of dollars already spent every year to solve this problem. And by the way, HVAC is exactly this, right? Like how much money is spent every year on HVAC? Mm. It's insanely large. And I'm just going to take this, you know, quality of solution and elevate it dramatically.
So this is the playbook, not necessarily that, or what I'm going to sort of, what I'm assuming you're saying, or what it seems like you're saying is that this is the mental model that you advocate for going into a consumer space. Because maybe, or at least it seems to me that if you're trying to build a B2B SaaS company, you know, you're going to build Datadog, it would be maybe challenging to describe that to your grandparents. But if you're building something for consumers, like the needs of people, like human beings are pretty similar to what they were generations ago, or even like you say, 1,000 years ago.
That's a really good refinement, actually, and you're probably right. Not to plug my, you know, give myself a plug for a 10-year-old blog post, but after finishing LearnDot, I wrote a blog post mostly for myself, and I had sort of four lessons for myself coming out of LearnDot, which is really the question you asked. And one of them was exactly this: solve ancient problems. And it's interesting in that LearnDot was a B2B company, but I think my disposition and my like real mindset has always been consumer. And maybe I didn't realize that until this conversation right now, because I think you're right. I mean, you could push it. I think you could say, like, I don't know, Salesforce, like, sure, yeah, like if you need to make, you know, sales as a business, you're going to need to like track your customers. And but it's, you're kind of stretching the analogy. I think you're right that it's mostly on the consumer side, that sort of solve ancient problems bit. And then the other three that were in that post and were completely still true today for me were solve your own problems. So also so you can have like real empathy with your customers. I also think that's easier in consumer.
Of course.
Because often, right? And then the other one is make no little plans. So this is kind of this 10-year commitment thing. It's like, if you're going to do something, make it really big. And not just for yourself and your own accomplishments, but that people are attracted to that. Everyone wants to be part of something really great in their life and something to be really proud of. So if you set a really high bar, it's going to attract a lot of other people. And then the other one is find some trend that is going to make the tide lift the boats, right? And sometimes this is like a technology-driven trend. Obviously, right now, AI is a big one. But for me, it's climate tech, right? And it's like all the energy around that. And, you know, COP, the big annual international conference just finished. And there's always, you know, commitments that come after that. So I've certainly benefited from like the tide lifting boats around the investment in the climate space. So those are the four. Find a trend you can attach yourself to, solve ancient problems, solve for yourself, and make, you know, ambitious plans.
Yeah, like I find that make ambitious plans one quite interesting out of that, because I think there's very reasonable people who will both push really hard on that idea, that will sort of, you know, make, you know, talk about some of the topics you've talked about today, which is if you're going to dedicate, you know, a huge chunk of your life to something, then swing big and go hard and do something that matters and really have a big vision. And that's how you track great people. And that's obviously helps you track investments that you can afford of great people. But then there's also, I think, a bit of backlash isn't exactly the word, although there's also backlash. But there's people who take a kind of different perspective, and they'll say, you know, there's a tendency in Silicon Valley to go too far with, you know, oh, okay, well, you know, we've created this thing, it's going to replace all currency in 5 years or something like that. And just the scale of the plan is not necessarily maybe it's necessary, but not sufficient, I guess, is the thing to maybe keep in mind with that one, in my view.
Yeah, I mean, completely. I mean, anyone can sort of put out grandiose ideas, right? The art is in actually making that feel achievable and tractable. So yeah, maybe it's not the entire story, but I certainly think it helps.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And especially when you're doing something that has a societal impact, it feels a lot better when it's a big, bold ambition rather than like, well, we're going to make 10 heat pumps and see how it goes.
Yeah, exactly.
we'll link up that blog post in the show notes for this episode. Another big piece of the backstory as you were telling it is this time you spent some time at Google's in-house incubator area 120. And I'm curious a bit about that model, because I often hear about, obviously Google is an exceptional company in various ways. And so the experience there might not fully generalize to other companies, but it's common for a large company that to get to a certain size and then they start to worry, or maybe just very plainly see that they're not innovating at the way that they used to, and it gets harder to do things, get things done, and there's more bureaucracy and things slow down. And so you end up like, oh, okay, well, we're going to have this org here and they're going to innovate and they're going to be our venture thing and we're going to have intrapreneurs and stuff like that. And yeah, occasionally hear successes from that model, but I hear a lot more, I guess, frustration with it from people that have gone through that pattern. So I'm curious if you have any kind of thoughts now, having gone through that, of like, is that a model that is valuable, but it really is just maybe tricky to do well? Or is it kind of inherently challenging to have the cake and eat it too, of being a large organization, but then also having these sort of free explorations within.
It's funny, everything you said in terms of your perception of that, like, that usually doesn't work. And you talk to people who've been through it, and, you know, more often than not, it wasn't a success. Sometimes there are a few. I mean, everyone who started Airone 20 knew that too, right? And we actually saw that as one of the opportunities and the challenge. It's like, we want to be the exception here. Like, we want to actually change the script and actually try to solve this and see how this is done. And also, I will say, like, you know, business leaders all over the place know this, and yet they still continue to create internal incubators. So, like, why is that? What is the, either the problem is so great, or the potential upside is so great they're willing to sort of roll the dice on it, or people are, you know, somewhat delusional, which, you know,
or both.
Those all those things might be true. Yeah. So I will start off with talking about, like, on the high level, without talking about Airone 20 specifically. I think the problem is very real. Innovator's dilemma is a very real thing. What I mean is the sort of like specific definition around, you have a large business that would have to get undermined in order to do the new thing. And it's really, really hard to pull money away from the cash cow that has built your business. And very, very few companies have done it successfully. I mean, Apple did it with the iPhone and the iPod, but like there's very few companies that can do that. And one way you can try to achieve that is you cordon off an area that sort of has the mandate to fly the pirate flag or whatever it is that could, you know, potentially undermine the core business. I also think that, like, culture stagnation does happen as well, where you get to the size where people see their jobs are to march forward as opposed to create new things. And so by creating a cordoned off area where people, you can attract those more entrepreneurial spirits, I think there's merit to that. Like, yes, that there is a different culture in sort of the people who like to create new things. But yet, these programs still mostly fail. And having gone through Airone 20, which I actually think did have some real successes, and we, even though a lot of them are not known to the outside world, because what they do is it would go and get rolled into an existing Google product, we would have pretty good metrics around how much business value we created versus, say, how much it cost to run the program. And it was a very good investment in terms, like, from a financial management perspective within Google, dollars put into Airone 20 always turned into, like, many more dollars for the business.
Okay.
But the way that often worked was we would, you know, create a small product or business that looked like it was independent, and then really commercialize it via an existing product. And sometimes you'd be like in, you know, cloud products. Like, there's one in cloud that does quite well called Call Center AI, CCAI is what we call it internally. That started as an Airone 20 project. And now it's like a major revenue driver for cloud. I think the reason these often fail is for the same reasons they're created, that those problems are real. And we hit those at Airone 20 too, where, like, we would try to do things that would pull things away from the core business. And you get some very powerful executives sending really angry emails to your executive or Sundar or whoever it is. And even where that was explicitly the mandate, you know, rocking the boat too much had real consequences. And also, I think on the talent side, like, it is a little bit harder to have this 10-year vision and this sort of swing for the fences kind of thing when you're inside that confines, because, you know, if you get to sort of your first, second base of success, you're going to get rolled back into the mothership.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a cap or a ceiling on how much business value you can create, sort of that you feel like you have, you know, a lot of autonomy over, sort of as a sort of interior, you know, like a startup CEO within the company. And actually, we stopped using the words startup CEOs because it started setting the wrong expectations, because these people were going to rejoin the mothership and have a whole bunch of levels above them. And, you know, Airone 20 is mostly actually wound down now. They kind of restructured it after the firing, or the layoffs, I should say, of January this year. And I'm not in the company anymore, so I don't know everything going on there. But I will say that, like, I'm really proud of the work we did. I do think that we were one of the most successful incubators. We had some incredible talent there. And that's actually, like, personally, this was the way I benefited the most, is that it was like a moth to the flame for, like, really ambitious, entrepreneurial, talented Googlers.
Mm-hmm.
And Google attracts, like, all this incredible talent, of course, and it has for decades. But sometimes people get there and they feel like they're a little bit confined.
Yep.
And Erin 20 was a place where people could come and work on their own ideas. If they did well, they could actually sort of shortcut the comp system for a while. They could shortcut the promo system. So it was like this fast track in the company, and there are very few of those. And so it was really hard to get in. It was, I think we had like a 5% acceptance rate or something. So like within Googlers, we're talking about the top 5% of the company. And both of my co-founders at Quilt, I met through Erin 20. And so I just got connected with like the best of the best at Google. And so it also was like, you know, personally really good for me in that way. So I'm really glad I spent that time there.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And mostly matches with all the things that I've heard of other programs like this and other companies. Obviously, they vary in the way that other companies vary. But it's interesting. There's a bit of this sense, and you've kind of reinforced that it is often good for the people who work within those programs, because of for the reasons you say, they often have a high talent concentration, they have more ambitious and creative teams sometimes than often normally than the larger orgs that they're within, and you often have a more reliable economic return than if you're going off and starting your own thing. So it can be a good kind of training ground, breeding ground for folks that then go off and do big ambitious things as well, which is interesting.
Yeah, but whether or not that actually brings back to the, you know, the mothership of the parent company in a meaningful way, like the way that people hope it's going to, I don't know. Like, how many internal corporate incubators can you point to that were the source of like the next big business line for some major company? You know what I mean? Like, did the X product come out of this? Like,
I'm sure there's
few
examples that we don't think of off the top of our heads because we sort of forget, oh yeah, that originally came from this thing. But this almost kind of proves the rule that I'm like, well, there must be at least one example.
Well, and at Google, there's a few things that started as 20% time. And that's why it was called Area 120. It was the idea of 20% time, 100% of the time.
Right, yeah.
And it was sort of carrying that flag. But in reality, all those major products that started as 20% time were well over a decade ago. People talk about Gmail.
And yeah, but a totally different Google, different culture, get different incentives at that time.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so that's all awesome. We have to at least talk about the heat pump opportunity and the challenges, because you have a software background and now you're the CEO of a hardware company that has very real physical, you know, these things need to get manufactured, they need to get installed. People just can't click on a website. Obviously, there's a website forthcoming where people will click on it and they will be able to learn things, but you have to actually manufacture things. So what have you been learning so far in that journey? What has been surprising to you about going from software to hardware?
A lot of the skills are actually really transferable, at least in my role. So my, like, call it the product manager role. I mean, even if I zoom in from being the CEO, but if you're trying to sort of design the right product, the fundamentals of, like, you start with who your customers are, what the problems are, and you kind of prioritize against that. You tell the story of success. There's some of this, you know, approach Amazon made popular. If you write the press release before it's like, all that
stuff.
You like
that, the press release first approach?
Yeah, or some version of that. Like, we wrote a Wirecutter review for Quilt.
Mm. Oh, I love that.
And early on, and it all totally applies. And so a lot of the skills are really transferable. I've also found it incredibly satisfying to, like, literally watch something I can touch with my hands get built. And from where we're sitting right now, like, I can see prototypes, like, right there. I think sometimes people who work in software for a long time have this itch to do something tangible. That's why you see a lot of, like, software developers take on, like, carpentry as hobbies and things like that. Because I think, like, we kind of have this desire to do something with our hands. And it certainly is hard. You'll hear that hardware is hard in the sense that, like, it feels like, I almost said exponential. I don't know if it's quite exponential, but quite a bit more complexity. So you just look at the sort of skill sets we needed to bring onto the team, that we needed to hire to even get something out of the gate. It's like 10x more than a software company. Like, you can basically launch a SaaS company with, you know, a couple people, like a handful of people or less that can write software, maybe someone doing sort of product business outreach, but you can have sort of a team of like 4 or 5 people build sort of a SaaS app. For us, we need, you know, electrical engineering, mechanical engineering at multiple levels, different kinds of it, right? We need, of course, firmware. Then we need your traditional software. We need manufacturing. We need quality engineering, like quality at the coming off the line. Like, there's just like all these skill sets that I never had any exposure to before. And they are completely deep, rich domains of knowledge with just as much level of expertise and complexity as software. And there's like 10 of them. And so, in a way, I really love it because I feel like I'm tapping into so much more human knowledge and capabilities and skill sets, and like the diversity of domains of expertise that we're able to incorporate into this product is so much larger than if I was just doing a traditional SaaS company, in my mind, that it's really satisfying. And it's been like, I think a very curious person. I really like learning things. And so like, I've been having to like get crash coursed on all this stuff, and it's been fantastic. But also, I've surrounded myself with really good people. Like my co-founder, where our CTO is, Matt, he's also one of my neighbors. He led the largest investment we made at Area 120, which was a robotics company. He's been doing hardware and robotics his whole life. He's an expert. And so I get to learn from him and draft from him and other people that we've hired who are really good at this.
Yeah, and that's a core piece of the puzzle that I certainly, if I was going to get into hardware, I would be very intensely making either Notion or Google Sheet lists of people that I would want to talk to both get on the team as well as learn from. Because one of, if not the most important thing that drives the success of any business is the people. And it's difficult to hire the world's best person that does a certain thing if you know nothing about that thing.
Yeah, totally.
This person is really confident. I guess they're good. And then you find out, like, after you're getting a failed units delivered from the factory, you're like, oh, they weren't good. Oh, no.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of that risk is just inherent, too, because also, I think you want a really complementary strength. I think, like, with Matt and I, that is true. Like, I bring things to the table that are not his strengths, and he clearly brings a lot of things to the table that are not my strengths. And, you know, to be totally candid, it's not like I knew for sure how good he was when we decided to go into this. I had seen some evidence, and I was able to piggyback on some of the things that, like, for example, Area 20 was able to help me evaluate by having him be in the program. But there's certainly, like, a certain amount of risk and leap of faith there.
You mentioned, and that makes a lot of sense. You mentioned sort of the difficulty of hardware and some aspects of things that the expertise and the breadth and the complexity. One of the things that scares me about the idea of being in hardware company is that I think of, and maybe this goes back to a little bit of your like product market fit search thinking, and maybe why not thinking that way is appealing to you, it being a hardware company now. But I think of building products as a very iterative, fundamentally iterative process. And I think of the levers of how to build product better, faster, and more successfully as a lot of it being about reducing cycle time, getting things in front of customers faster, getting things in my own hands faster, playing with things soon, rapidly, and then iterating a lot of times. And fundamentally, you know, not knowing exactly the logistics of getting these prototypes built and manufactured and installed in a home, but like that's not like a thing that you can have multiple iterations per day, or at least I don't think of them as having multiple iterations per day. So how has that changed how you think about product development in that, or is it kind of you just find ways to make iteration fast, even though it's not at the macro scale, literally getting installed in your home multiple times a day with what other product changes we've made?
Yeah, I think it's more like that. And when we're like, it actually is very iterative. And this goes back to me maybe being surprised at how like not different it felt. And, you know, in my experience, even with software products, you're not really trying new, like, substantial product ideas every day. Yeah, there's people who like, you know, run continuous integration and constantly push. But like in reality, you probably have some like product, you know, that are product hypotheses that are a little bit deeper. They're a new feature or they're like some new flow that's got to be built out. You might run an experiment around it. But like the iteration, even a really fast company, is usually a few weeks to test like real significant product ideas, and often a lot more than weeks. And that's about the pace of our iteration here. So we started with really lightweight prototypes that we could build. You prototype different things. So we prototype the industrial design that has basically a dummy box, but can let us know how the product looks and feels in your hand and on the wall. We'd go install those in houses. It was my house and Matt's house, and literally like essentially styrofoam boxes, but we just put them in rooms and live with them and see how they felt.
Mm.
And in parallel, we would prototype, you know, the more internal, like call it guts of the system, where it didn't look very pretty, but we wanted to make sure that it all worked. And you know, we did a bunch of prototypes at that level. It doesn't feel that different. Like if I look on the wall over there, I see like 8 different industrial design concepts that we all prototyped. And one of those is the one that is now, has passed the evolutionary process and is now has offspring that are the current version. It's not the same thing because it has iterated. And, you know, right now we're doing an install about once every 2 weeks, and that's going to pick up the pace. There is one thing that is very different that is worth talking about. Are you familiar with the idea of tooling, what that means in hardware businesses?
Yeah, in that like the factory has tools that can produce the product, and that if you change the product, they have to change the tooling, and that can be very expensive depending on the process.
Yeah, exactly. And they generally look like molds that are injected, plastic molds that are specifically for the shapes of the components of your product. So the important part is that they're not reusable by the factory for other customers. So you have to invest in them because they're really just your IP. They're the shape of your specific product. And they're very expensive to make, very, very expensive to make, like multi-million dollars often, are hard to change because it's expensive to make and they're hard to change. So we can prototype pretty quickly right now where we're 3D printing a lot of parts and we haven't invested in tooling yet. But once you sort of invest in tooling, you've kind of locked in a lot of stuff. And so then things get harder to change. But I'd also say that even with software, like there are things that once you've shipped it and it's in production and people are using it and people are, you know, you've invested in the data structure, like it's hard. It's hard to migrate databases. It's hard to take features away from people that they're invested in. And so there are still analogies there where, you know, in reality, there are lots of things that are still hard to change on the software side once it gets, you know, to a certain level of maturity.
Yeah, but God bless 3D printing.
God bless 3D printing for sure. And we also use CNC machines.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, I was initially surprised as I got a little more familiar with, you know, hardware startups in the modern age, how much CNC and 3D printing is happening, like how far and how much money and time and effort sometimes teams will spend doing that as opposed to going to like, well, let's just, because I'm in software, I'm like, well, let's just put it in production. But like put it in production means like spend $1 million on tooling to be able to actually produce this. It's like, maybe let's just spend $100,000 on CNC, you know, and then you can move a lot faster.
Yeah.
One topic I'd like to touch on before we run out of time is geography. So you mentioned that we both started our careers in Vancouver and you moved to the Bay Area, but kept a foot in Vancouver. I stayed in Vancouver, but have a foot in the Bay Area. I'm curious, like having built startups in both cities, obviously in very different conditions, like the student out of school versus coming from Area 120, where you know all these like talented founders and have all these connections in the Bay Area. But what have you learned about the kind of the opportunities and practicalities of starting, scaling businesses inside and outside of the Bay Area? Because I know we have like a healthy share of folks who listen to the show that are both in the Bay Area as well as elsewhere.
Yeah, my honest answer is going to be like, it's going to really annoy most people who are not in the Bay Area.
Oh, no.
But that's my honest answer, is that it's just like a cheat code being down here. It is like Matt, who's our CTO, who is like probably the reason that if we're going to have any level of success here building hardware, like if I did not have him as my co-founder, I would not be able to do this successfully. He's literally my neighbor, like three blocks from me. And part of the way I was able to recruit him was I was like, let's go grab a coffee. Let's go for a walk over lunch. And I could physically walk to his house. There's many, many, many examples like this. Like, one of the founding electrical engineers on the iPhone. This guy's in the Computer History Museum, like literally like top 0.001% in the world kind of thing. Lives a few blocks from here. And he also did the first prototype of the Nest thermostat with like Tony Fadell and stuff. And just wanted to like come hang out with us because he heard we were doing something cool. So we just like come and advise us. It really feels like a cheat code. And like, I'm sorry to say that. And the answer should not be like everyone has to move to the Bay Area. And for sure, certainly like, I had a bunch of advantages because I'm much more mature in my career than I was when I started LearnUp. And you obviously can build great companies anywhere in the world, but there's a reason so many of them are here, and that network effects are real. And part of the network effect is the community of the density of talent at all levels of the ecosystem. So of course there's investors, like there's probably more investors within, I don't know, 2 miles where I'm sitting than there is in all of Canada. I mean that seriously, like I'm actually maybe only 2 miles from Sandhill Road. So it's kind of cheating, but that is real. And you know, in terms of like great hardware engineers who've built products like the iPhone or the Nest thermostat or, you know, the Google watch I'm wearing, like they're probably all sitting within 10 miles of me, or a lot of them are, right? I'm 15 miles from Cupertino right now. So it just feels like a cheat code. That said, that is, like I said, really not productive for people who aren't here. So I think that if I could say something, I think there are their own versions of strengths. So like, this maybe isn't the most insightful thing ever to say, but you know, certain sort of verticals get a certain density of talent around it. So like, I'm trying to build a hardware product with a really great consumer facing component. It's good that I'm near Apple, right? There's a lot of people who kind of fall off of that aura. if I wanted to build a Canadian company and I wanted to do something around e-commerce, it's probably good to move to Ottawa or, you know, like be near Shopify because that's now a world-class company in that domain. And so there are other things that might be able to like spin off of that. And I think that like that applies for like all around the world where they're you know, people have their levels of expertise and they can sort of build on that versus kind of try to like go after the whole kind of tech ecosystem at once.
Yeah, and that really resonates. Obviously, I have an inclination to think from a Vancouver perspective, and I think it was possible here. But something that I've seen, a pattern that kind of reinforces what you're saying, is that people benefit a lot from thinking about where they're building, what they're building, the team that is available, and the people that are available, and you know, leveraging. I don't super love the word leveraging in this context, but leveraging the people that they know and can know that are maybe that are neighbors or that that you can go on a walk with, a walk and talk, you know, once a month with somebody who really knows something. And, you know, like you say, if you're in Ottawa, maybe that means e-commerce. And if you're in Vancouver, there's certain, you know, startups and areas that we have a lot of expertise in and some really talented people who have built businesses of certain kinds. And then there's some areas where it's kind of like chip manufacturing. Like probably maybe don't start that in Vancouver. And so you can take that in two ways. I think you can take that in a, I guess that means I need to move to the place that is best suited to the thing I want to found, which if you're very mission-driven, you're like, I absolutely am going to be making the next competitor to Intel or whatever, then it's like, yeah, maybe you want to be in Taiwan or maybe you want to be in you know, at least not in Vancouver. But on the other hand, you can work in the other direction. You can say, okay, well, what are the things that are well-suited to where I am? And then obviously the other piece of that is that there's the Bay Area, which is it's very, very unique. But then there's also this second tier of, there's a lot of places like Vancouver, but also like New York. Like I'm actually, it seems like, and I don't know if this is just sampling bias, but I've been running into and meeting people working in really well-run, interesting startups out of New York, more so in the last like couple of years than, you know, 5 or 10 years ago. Obviously New York has long had a good startup ecosystem. And if you live somewhere that is not the Bay Area, but is within easy flight of the Bay Area, that can also be, you know, you can get some subset of that advantage. You're not necessarily going to go on weekly walks with the person who created the iPod or whatever. But as you ramp up in terms of your understanding and your connections and you build a network and you build a reputation for doing good work, you get opportunities to be able to do that stuff. As long as, you know, obviously if you're in somewhere where you can't, or maybe for visa situation, you can't visit the Bay Area, then that's challenging. But
yeah, for sure. And I actually think there's a whole other angle here that I think there's been a bigger rift around, I mean, this is obvious to say, but around remote versus in-person since COVID, and that there is now a large part of the tech economy that is fully remote and kind of plans to be always. And then that actually obviously creates a lot of opportunities for other regions to access the exact same talent, especially if you're in the same time zone or close to the same time zone. So I think for places like Vancouver, it's an incredible opportunity. And maybe they just want to, you know, what are those equivalent online networks that are being formed for remote? People are primarily remote. By the way, taking the exact opposite, because we're a hardware company. We have a lot of people in the office. We've actually taken the kind of hardline other position where we're currently, we don't have any roles open to remote, even software roles. But I think it's fine to be either one as long as you lean into it. The middle ground, especially as a small company, can be difficult. So that's, I'm going to throw that out there too, that there's sort of this like internet as its own geography, disjoint from physical space. Maybe it's more of a time zone constraint. That is an interesting opportunity that is, you know, it's been there for a while, but it's really coming to its own today.
Yeah, and obviously there's the, as we've talked about on the show before, there's the tendency for teams who are working on something like a brand new hardware product to benefit a lot from being physically co-located. And I think there's a bit of a tendency for teams that are, although in some ways you describe what you're doing as this approach, I think there is something fundamentally difficult about what you're doing, but that are building better mousetrap, that it's like a well-understood problem where like we're definitely executing on a mission rather than doing something that is really fundamentally uncertain, seem to have an easier time building a really successful remote distributed culture where everything is asynchronous. and they're across time zones, or even just in maybe North America, but they're fully remote. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting to continue to watch that. I'm in the same position as you, as someone who comes from a perspective of kind of like leans towards the in-person thing, but then also very aware that people are being very successful with the remote setup. So I don't cast aspersions on that approach as well. If it's delivering results, it's delivering results, right?
Mm-hmm. No, totally agree.
So you're heads down, you're working on Quilt. You can see prototypes from where you are. I know that you have, the product is now installed in your home, but we can't yet see it. If we were to chat in a year, well, you and I will chat in less than a year, we'll be in touch. But if we were to chat in a year, what would you want us to hear? Where would we want to be? What should we be kind of looking forward to for the next short, medium term for you, without having to make any promises that you can't reveal as of yet?
Yeah, so I certainly think a year from now, our product will be launched, the pricing will be out there, the photos will be out there, videos will be out there. It'll be very clear what we're building. And whether or not that resonates with people is one of the big open questions of the next year. I'm very optimistic that it will. I am incredibly happy with it already in my home, and I have essentially a prototype, an early build. But yeah, so I'm hoping there's a lot of demand, of course, a lot of excitement for the product. I hope that we are getting into as many homes as possible. To bring this back to the big climate mission, is like, we have to sunset a lot of furnaces. And it's actually really cool building this company where business impact and climate impact are basically in perfect alignment. Like, the way that we create the climate impact is by building a big company that can, because we need that in order to be able to support getting into millions and tens of millions of homes. Like, you can't do that as, you know, a 30-person company, just the operations of it and everything else. So a year from now, we're not going to be global. We're not even going to be national in the U.S. yet. And unfortunately, we probably won't be in Canada a year from now. But I certainly hope there will be a few geographies in the U.S. where we are actively installing in homes. We have really, you know, happy customers that are benefiting from our system. They're more comfortable in their home. They have lower energy bills, and they have a lower CO2 footprint. So that's where I hope we are a year from now. And then, you know, if we're talking again a year, then we can talk about future products to come.
Nice. Well, I'm looking forward to that. Thank you so much, Paul, for being on the show. Where can people go to learn more about you and your work?
Well, you can learn more about Quilt at Quilt, Quilt, just like the thing you put on your bed to keep you warm, quilt.com. You can learn more about me. I mean, honestly, kind of LinkedIn is a good place. Like, I do post on there. I have a personal website, but I don't update it very often. I have a complicated relationship with Twitter, so I'm not very active on that anymore. Instagram, we have a Quilt Instagram as well. I'm going to start build up my own presence there as well. So Quilt, it's currently Quilt Heat Pump is the handle. I'm going to try to get a better one. And I'm Paul R. Lambert on Instagram.
Awesome. Well, I'll link those up in the show notes. And again, appreciate you being on the show. It's always fun chatting.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you. Thanks, Alan. This was fun.
It Shipped That Way is brought to you by Steam Clock Software. If you're a growing business and your customers need a really nice mobile app, get in touch with Steam Clock. That's it for today. You can give us feedback, follow us on social media, rate the show, let us know who you'd like to be on the show by going to itshipped.fm/contact. And until next time, keep shipping.